brief introduction to ADM and ADM gravity in 3 plus 1. So imagine here you have a space-time, and I'm drawing it like a block because I want it to be, you know, one direction of space, sorry, one direction of time, two of space. And the Hamiltonian formalism starts by splitting this, right? It split this into something, into what we call a foliation. One direction is time, the other direction is space. So you think about these as these definitions of instantaneous degrees of freedom, basically. What is the spatial metric and how it evolves in time? And it turns out that when you take the Eisenhower action and you decompose it in this form, and then you transform it into, you take the Eisenhower action. So this is for dimension. And let me write it like this. And then you transform it into 3 plus 1, and you do a Legendre transformation into momentum. You're going to get a Hamiltonian formalism. And it turns out that it's written in terms of things. Let me write it like this. And so it basically turns out that there are two, when you work out the equations of motion and everything, there are two constraints on the theory, which means that in this Hamiltonian formalism, you can't just choose whichever initial momentum you'd like here. The momentum of the metric degrees of freedom should be seen, or the momentum conjugate to the metric degrees of freedom are seen as how the metric evolves, basically, right? So it turns out you can't really choose this, and you have these two constraints. You have one constraint. Let's just write it like this. This is a function of let's say GAB and PiAB, which are my metric, the spatial ones. Okay, and you have another one, which is the momentum one. Okay, again, I'm not going to write it down because I'm not going to need it. So they have different geometric interpretations. The momentum constraint basically says that, okay, so if you're gonna have quantities that are compatible with this constraint, that means that they have to be diffeomorphism invariant, basically. You can also see this, and this is the crucial point about this, is that in phase space has an extra interesting structure that in a Lagrangian framework you can do, but it takes a little bit more work. And that is that any function of this form, also any function in phase space, has a symplectic flow associated to it through the Poisson bracket, right? So you have some Poisson bracket in phase space, you have some symplectic flow associated to functions like this. And so basically I can define a flow, let's say, about this, let's write it like this. I smear this. This is one per space point. It's one constraint per space point here. And I smear this, and I, let's say, with a vector field, I'm not going to put chi. So you can generate a transformation in a function of g and pi. So this is basically a gauge transformation by calculating the Poisson bracket of the integral of hi. Chi I with whatever function you had, okay? So, all right, this is the introduction. And you think about this as like this. You have these functions, and they define these surfaces on phase space, right? Because I'm saying, okay, I demand that this function is zero. What are the points in phase space that respect this condition? And then you have these submersion theorems and so on in differential geometry, and you can see if they define surfaces. But more than that, through the Poisson bracket, they also define like little vectors. They're little flows. They're taking things along their flow. They're defining these little transformations, right? Because a vector also acts on functions in the same form, differentiating. And you can see if like does this flow stay on this surface or not? Does it leave the surface? And this is basically what people would say. So, for instance, imagine this is a charge. Imagine that h equals 0 is like a charge. Let's say e equals 0, right? Not, and then you want the time evolution or whatever transformation that generates to maintain that charge, okay? And this in the lingo is called like, well, roughly speaking, I'm skipping a lot of steps here because I only have 10 minutes. It's called first class, okay? So first class constraints means it's a family of constraints and they all keep each other on the surface that they mutually define, all right? Their flow keeps it on the surface. It doesn't leave, it maintains that charge. It conserves the charge that they define. So what is interesting about gravity is that, well, these constraints here, they are first class amongst themselves. So they keep each other, they conserve each other. But there's a different way of looking at this. Now I have to introduce a different thing, which is which are gauge transformations. And what happens here is that constraints, usually, for instance, diffeomorphisms or charge, they are associated to gauge transformations, right? And usually what you do is if you have a gauge direction here defined in the surface, you define some kind of a section or a gauge fixing here. And it turns out, I don't have time to explain it here, but there are very special properties to theories when you choose the theory here in this gauge section, such that the gauge section itself, this section itself is defined by another surface in phase space, which also has its own gauge symmetries, okay? So basically, you're saying, okay, I have these two surfaces defined by some functions in phase space, and they each have associated to them some charges. And now, the interesting thing that happens is that one can fix the gauge symmetry of the other. And this happens in gravity, okay, in general relativity. Well, people have been able to solve generically the initial value problem of gravity, which is basically this, by choosing a gauge which is called York gauge. The York gauge in gravity, or CMC gauge, says the following. It says that, okay, I'm gonna just look at initial data that satisfies that the trace of pi equals a spatial constant. So let me write this as, it's equal to its own integral. Oh, sorry, there's no square root g. I might normalize this, so 1 over volume. And I'm looking at compact spatial surfaces. And this condition is very important for numerical relativists. They use this a lot to solve generically. So you give them some initial value on a surface, back to that picture, and say, okay, but I demand that my momentum has a constant trace all over the surface. Then you can solve. Then you can find solutions of the theory. This condition physically means that these surfaces are defined by people measuring the time by the Hubble constant, basically. Okay, so people will say, okay, we all measure the same Hubble expansion, and so this is one instant of time, and so on. And it seems very physical. But there's something else that is very interesting about this. And what is very special about trace pi is that its flow in phase space, okay, so I'm gonna smear it by some function rho, and its flow on phase space generates, so let me write it with just GB first. Its flow on phase space generates conformal transformations, spatial conformal transformations, okay? So basically, I smear it and it blows up the metric, and it blows up the momenta in the inverse way because the momenta gets diluted by conformal transformations because it's extrinsic. So people were thinking about this, in particular Julian Barber. He was thinking about, not in these terms, but thinking about in terms of relation or Machian ways of thinking about gravity, they were introducing notions that we should have, if we have a law of the instant, if we basically have a physical law that is based on space and time as separate entities, and space as flowing through time, that you should have something that that is conformally invariant, or that doesn't depend, that scale itself is relative, spatial scale is relative. And people were thinking about this, and this matches basically what the notion of York time means for the solution of gravity. And there's, so there's, what we see here is that this surface, so if we just fix pi equals zero, let's say, it creates a surface like this, and it intersects the surface of gravity in a way that I described for you before. So it keeps it has this flow on that surface there, and intersects the surface of ADM scalar momentum transversely, and it fixes that gauge. And there are properties of this thing, of the theory, of a theory that you would form in this intersection, that are very special, especially if you go to quantization. The BRST formulation of a theory in an intersection like this, if you choose what they call a gauge-fixing fermion to be produced by a surface like this that intersects the other, the theory here has special properties that are called symmetry doubling. That basically they have more BRST charges. The BRST Hamiltonian has more BRST charges. Okay, I'm not going to go through that. So now finally, I'm going to talk about charge quantization from a number operator. And so the interesting thing here is that what I was looking for is, okay, just look in phase space. Forget about gravity. Forget about what we know about gravity. And let me just look on phase space for functions. Let's call it f. Functions of, let's say, local functions of phase space. That first of all, commute with the spatial diffeomorphisms, okay, and with themselves. So they're first class. They define these surfaces with these arrows here, and these arrows also contain the arrows of the diffeomorphism constraint. And let's call the other, S, or I already used all the letters that I know, so let's call it B of G and pi. And then what you start doing is that let's look for two of these functions that there are other things that I'm not going to say. There's fine print and all this, but then you basically look for two of these of constraint surfaces in this that define the same dimension of surface as ADM, because you want two dynamical propagating degrees of freedom that also have this property, that they also intersect transversely and could define a theory with those properties. And the interesting thing is that this is very constrained. Basically, what you get is that the ADM constraint, without starting with gravity, without even starting with time, really, I mean, you do have momenta here, but you have no notion of time, you get basically one choice of one of the constraints is basically an extended ADM constraint. Let me call it ADM bar, just because of MS bar. And the constraint is basically this. So this would be the ADM constraint that I'm writing to you, and I'll write you what the difference is. So this is a difference in the usual way. Let me write here just the right density weights. So this is one of the constraints that you get. There are two other constraints that can gauge fix it, but the only one that works generically on, that is generic in phase space, is basically trace pi equals a constant, spatial constant, as I wrote there. Or rather, I should have written, well, the same way that I wrote there. And for me, so this is, so, oh, I forgot to mention, so this is also a difference. And so it's funny that there are such little ways, if you take this as a construction principle, if you take this two intersecting surfaces on phase space as a construction principle, if you want to generate that when they generate a gravitational theory with two dynamical propagating degrees of freedom, it's funny that it's so constrained, but yet it's not completely constrained. There is this term here that has a funny effect that you see everything else is time reversal invariant. This is the only term that could potentially break time reversal symmetry. And it's funny that this construction allows it. I guess that's it. I think it's roughly 10 minutes.
All right, let's take one quick question, if there's a quick question on this. Going once, going twice. Okay, let's thank Enrique.
Thanks for improvisation, eh?
Sure.
Here we have Cole, talking about charge quantization from a number operator.
Oh, Cole Curie.
Going to write down some early related work. So can everybody hear me at the back? Can you hear me? No? Turn it up. Is it okay? Okay. So I want to tell you about four special algebras. These are the real numbers, the complex numbers, the quaternions, and the octonions. These are the only four normed algebras over the real numbers where the concept of division is possible. The real numbers are almost everywhere in physics, and they've been around since at least 500 BC. It took roughly 2,000 years before people came to consider the complex numbers. The idea must have been outrageous at the time to consider a number system based on the square root of minus one. But today we know the complex numbers to be central to quantum theory. A few hundred years later, Hamilton found the quaternions, and whether people realize it or not, the quaternions are behind the scenes every time we talk about SU2 or the Lorentz group. The same year that the quaternions were found, so were the octonions. But the octonions are not central to any widely accepted theory in physics. It's hard not to wonder, though, is it really the case that nature was able to make full use of R, C, and H, but it didn't know what to do with O? Incidentally, when working with the division algebras, you often find that it's more convenient to deal with a tensor product of these things instead of each division algebra separately. So loosely speaking, the complex quaternions are going to give Lorentzian degrees of freedom, and the complex octonions are going to give the other internal degrees of freedom. So the basic outline for this talk is as follows. We're going to start with the complex quaternions. We're going to see that they're related to a Clifford algebra. And once we have a Clifford algebra, we're pretty much home free, because from here we know how to build spinners. So we're going to use a spinner construction, and we're going to find that we get left and right-handed vial spinners. Then the idea is to repeat the same process, this time with the complex octonions. So we're going to see that they're related to a Clifford algebra. And then from here, we're going to use the same spinner construction as before, except this time, what are we going to get? The idea is here, we're going to get quarks and leptons. In the process, we're going to be able to introduce a new electric charge operator, Q. This Q is striking because it offers an explanation as to why electric charge is quantized. So just to repeat, we're going to start with these algebras. We're going to see that they're related to Clifford algebras. And then we're going to use a spinner construction. In this case, we're going to get left and right-handed vial spinners. And in this case, we're going to get a full generation of quarks and leptons. So you might ask, why do we need to go through Clifford algebras? Like, why are Clifford algebras important? Clifford algebras are important because spinners can be defined as minimal left ideals of Clifford algebras. So just to remind you about what an ideal is, let's say I have some algebra A. Then an ideal is a subalgebra, whereby if I were to take an element out of the ideal and multiply it by any element out of the algebra, it doesn't matter which one it is, then their product will necessarily be pulled back inside the ideal. So loosely speaking, you can think of ideal as an algebra's version of a black hole, in that it will pull any element into itself via multiplication. Now, a minimal left ideal is a left ideal that has no other non-trivial left ideals inside it. So let's see what happens when we take our algebra A to be the complex quaternions. What are we going to get as minimal left ideals? We're going to find minimal left ideals using the complex quaternions. The way we're going to do this is we're going to introduce a particular projector, which is called V. So this projector, it turns out, is going to act a little bit like a vacuum state. So the way to get the minimal left ideal is we left multiply the algebras of C cross H onto our projector. So that's our minimal left ideal. And it turns out that this space is too complex dimensional. It's spanned, oh, sorry, before I move on, it's the complex quaternions give a representation of the Clifford algebra CL2. So we're really multiplying CL2 onto V. So that's our minimal left ideal. So this space is too complex dimensional, and it's spanned by the vectors V and alpha dagger V. So you can see that this thing looks a little bit like a Fock space. It's not a very big Fock space. It's only got one alpha and one alpha dagger. So if I were to now apply sigma z over 2 onto my basis vectors, I'd find that the first one has an eigenvalue of 1/2, and the other one has an eigenvalue of minus 1/2. So I can identify these things as spin up and spin down states, and I'll identify the whole thing as a left-handed vial spinner. So whether you choose left or right here doesn't matter. Then the idea is we're going to repeat the same process, this time using V star. When we do this, we get a new linearly independent space, which we're going to identify as a right-handed spinner. So these two spaces are linearly independent from each other, and they're also related by the complex conjugate. So in the case of the complex quaternions, we found minimal left ideals, and our result was that we got left and right-handed vial spinners. So now let's go to the complex Arctonians and see, let's go through the exact same procedure. So we're going to find minimal left ideals using the complex Arctonians. So this is going to run in the exact same way as before. We're going to start with a projector. And this projector, we're going to call it V. And it turns out V is going to act again like a vacuum state. Then it turns out this time, the Clifford algebra associated with the complex Arctonians is CL6. So if people want to know why CL6 and the complex Arctonians are related, feel free to ask me afterwards. So what we're going to do here is the same as before. We just left multiply CL6 onto our projector, and this gives us our minimal left ideal. So in this case, it turns out that this object is 8 complex dimensional, and again, it's going to look a little bit like a Fock space. Then we're going to do the exact same thing as we did before. We multiply this thing onto V star, and again, we're going to get a linearly independent space from the first, which is again related by the complex conjugate. So in the case of the complex quaternions, we had a really small Fock space. There was only one alpha and one alpha dagger. But here we're going to have 3 alphas and 3 alpha daggers. So we can use these raising and lowering operators to make a number operator in the usual way. That's our number operator. And this thing's going to be important in a minute. So now that we know how to build those minimal left ideals, we want to take a look at what the basis vectors look like. We want to be able to identify these things. So we're going to write one ideal on the left and the other ideal on the right. So starting at the bottom left, our first basis vector is V. That's our vacuum state, or what we're calling the vacuum. On the next level up, we have objects that look like alpha dagger V. On the next level, we have objects with 2 alpha daggers and then V. And at the very top, we have 3 alpha daggers and then V. So you can see this looks like a Fock space. Now we can fill in the complex conjugate space, and this is what we get. So now that we know what the basis vectors look like for both of those ideals, we want to be able to identify what they are physically. So in the case of the complex quaternions, we had the 2 states were spin up and spin down states. But here, what are these physically? So back in the early 70s, Gunaydin and Gersay showed SU3 quark structure in the Arctonians. So SU3 is a subgroup of G2, and G2 is the automorphism group of the Arctonians. So what we're going to do is we're going to apply the SU3 generators from Gunaydin and Gersay, and we're going to apply it onto our ideals. So starting on the left, let's start at the bottom left. We find that the thing we're calling the vacuum state transforms as a singlet under SU3. On the next level up, those 3 objects are going to behave like an anti-triplet. On the next level up, those next 3 objects, they behave like a triplet. And then finally, at the very top, under SU3, the very top object behaves like a singlet. And then we can fill in the complex conjugate space, and this is what we get. A singlet, a triplet, an anti-triplet, and a singlet. But this still isn't enough information to be able to identify what these states are. So let's go back to the number operator. Let's look at the eigenvalues of that number operator. So it turns out the eigenvalues of n are 0, 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 2, and 3, which doesn't look like anything until you divide it by 3. Now we have 0, 1 third, 1 third, 1 third, 2 thirds, 2 thirds, 2 thirds, and 1. Well, now those look like electric charges. So let's define the electric charge operator Q to be the number operator divided by 3. Let's see how Q acts on our states. So starting again at the bottom left, we find that the thing that we call the vacuum has got charge 0. On the next level up, all 3 of those objects have the same charge. That charge is 1/3. On the next level up, we have the next 3, they've got charge 2/3, and at the very top, we have a charge of +1. So you can see how this is a number operator divided by 3. A number operator is going to count the number of alpha daggers on each level. So here, at the vacuum, we've got no alpha daggers, 0 alpha daggers, so we get 0 charge. 1 alpha dagger, 1/3. 2 alpha daggers, 2 thirds, and 3 alpha daggers, 3 thirds. So we can fill in the complex conjugate space, and that's what we get. So now we have enough information to be able to start labeling what these states are. So starting at the bottom left, the object we're calling a vacuum, it's a singlet under SU3, and it's got zero charge. So that means it's either a neutrino or an antineutrino. And for a reason that will be clear in a minute, I'm going to call this a neutrino. On the next level, we have something that is an anti-triplet under SU3, and it's got charge 1/3. Those are anti-down quarks. On the next level, we have a triplet under SU3 with charge 2/3. Those are up quarks. And at the very top, we have something which is a singlet under SU3 with charge +1. That's positron. Moving to the bottom right, again, we have something which is a singlet under SU3 with charge 0. So that's either a neutrino or an antineutrino. So here I'm going to say antineutrino. On the next level, we have something which is a triplet with charge -1/3. Those are down quarks. On the next level, we have an anti-triplet with charge -2/3. Those are anti-up quarks. And then finally at the top, we have something which is a singlet under SU3 with charge -1. That's, of course, the electron. So we just found minimal left ideals using the complex octonions, and what did we get? We have a full generation of quarks and leptons under SU3 and the electromagnetic U1. Let's summarize the results. We were able to generalize left and right-handed vial spinners using the complex octonions to give enough degrees of freedom for a full generation of quarks and leptons. We then took the SU3 generators of Gunaitin and Gersi, and we applied them to our ideals, and we found that SU3 worked as it should. We were then able to introduce a new electric charge operator, Q, which assigned the correct charges for a full generation. But not only did we get the charges right, those charges fit in perfectly with the SU3 representations. So there was no reason to have expected the charges to fit with the SU3 representations, but they did. Next, if we're now allowed to assume that the neutrino goes over on the left and the antineutrino goes on the right, then you'll notice that the first ideal packaged all of the isospin up states together, and the second ideal packaged all of the isospin down states together. So we don't have SU2 yet, but this model seems to know something about SU2. Next, it turns out in this formalism that particle and antiparticle are related simply by the complex conjugate. So it's a very natural formalism. And finally, this electric charge operator that we introduced, Q, is equal to a number operator divided by 3. This electric charge is striking because it offers an explanation as to why electric charge is quantized.
Questions? Too bad you don't predict a new particle.
There's in future work there should be a right-handed neutrino, but that's
So when you say towards SU2, do you want to include extra structure to account for SU2 or?
So I expect that SU2 should come into it, and you can I don't know if it's maybe
there's.
So each of these things are ideals, and SU3, you can see that SU3 and U1 have to be, they come in through left multiplication. Because these things are ideals, SU3 and U1 acting on the left will only map one of these ideals to itself. But for SU2, you need these things to map between each other. And so SU2, you can see, is already going to come in via right multiplication.
So the usual explanation for charge quantization if you want to call it an explanation, is that the gauge group associated to it is compact.
Right.
And then sometimes people try to enforce that by embedding it in a larger gauge group, you know, the gut models and so on.
Right.
So do you see any connection between this explanation of quantization and compactness of a gauge group?
So at this point, there's no reason to expect to be forced into a compact gauge group. So right now, this is just at the Lie algebra level. So there isn't a reason at this point to see why you need to embed this into a grand unified theory.
Well, I'm not saying it has to be grand unified. I'm just saying, can you see any connection? Suppose you didn't. Enlarge the gauge group.
Yeah, these
results. Is there some way of seeing that this quantization is connected to the U1 compactness of U1? You're saying
yeah,
no.
I don't know. So at this point, this is completely at the Lie algebra level. So I.
One last question, maybe. Okay. If not, let's thank Cole again.